You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 25th to the 31st of January 2018. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by writer Ellie Bothwell, news editor Chris Havergal, books editor Matthew Rice, and data editor Simon Baker. Campaigns for an academic boycott of Israel are likely to be ramped up in the wake of a move to bring HE institutions in the West Bank settlement under Israeli law. That's according to some scholars, and Ellie will bring us the latest on that in just a moment. The World Economic Forum meets in Davos this week. Its community of universities, the Global University Leaders Forum, boasts some impressive figures when it comes to both research clout and industrial links. And we take a look, an in-depth look at the group's work this week. I spoke to Simon a little earlier about that. And a group of public colleges in the US is to offer degrees with guarantees. If their graduates fail to pass professional licensing exams after leaving university, they can return to college to be retrained. Chris Havergal takes us through that story. And we've got Matthew here. So, of course, there will be a rundown of this week's books section too. But we'll start first, Ellie, with that news story. Academic boycott of Israel has been on the cards for a while, and some people indeed take part in it, but campaigns for such a boycott are likely to be ramped up. Why is that? What's happening?
Yeah, so there's a new law that's working its way through Parliament at the moment that would basically mean that any higher education institutions in the West Bank settlements would come under Israeli law. At the moment, they've got their own sort of council for higher education. There are several colleges that it would impact, but there's one university, which is Ariel University, which would then come under Israeli law. And the concerns are that academics in Western sort of countries would be concerned about this because some argue that essentially it's the first annexation to Israel of a part of the occupied territories in 50 years, that there'd be, big concerns about this, and that, first of all, that academics in countries like the UK, the US, Europe would, stop working with scholars in Israel potentially, and also that European funding organisations would stop funding research in universities that are in the main, Israel proper.
So the institutions in the West Bank settlement at present, they have a sort of independent governing. Is that the way it works at the moment?
Yeah, well, they've got their sort of own council for higher education, for the region. But Ariel University isn't considered legal by international law. Israel considers it a legal university, but it's kind of illegal. So they've already been, boycotts, of that university. But the concern here is that, all universities in the kind of main part of Israel could potentially face boycotts. I spoke to one professor who's kind of spearheaded a campaign against the bill. And he said that, it's most likely to be kind of hidden boycotts. It's not necessarily going to be a whole university in the UK that would stop working with an Israeli university, but it would be things like international journal editors rejecting papers from Israelis, without sort of giving the real reasons, or PhD graduates from Israel being unable to secure postdoctoral positions abroad.
Mm. It's really hard to monitor, I suppose, the impact of these boycotts. We've had boycotts, Chris, of course, in the news section quite regularly recently. It's one of those things where you can see the reasons behind it, but it can be quite problematic when academia is supposed to be above that sort of thing. Everyone deserves to be discussed and everyone deserves to be talked to.
Yeah, I think it's always a difficult debate. I think what perhaps is slightly different about this case is that, while the settlements, which, as we say, are considered illegal under national law, have sort of maybe been seen as being sort of a separate issue to many of the issues facing universities in the rest of Israel, this seems very much to put higher education very much at the centre of the debate over the West Bank settlements. Looking at Ellie's reporting on this, it seems to be very much a politicised move inside Israel. You know, it's being pushed by the education minister, who's the member of a right-wing party. So, I mean, you know, I suspect that this, you know, could potentially have a significant impact.
Indeed.
I suspect that it's partly to wind up Israeli academics and the rest of Israel, many of whom, in effect, boycott Ariel, and they refuse to collaborate with it. And as we know, right-wing politicians love winding up liberals.
Indeed. Well, you can read that story in full on page 6 of the magazine, of course, on timeshighereducation.com as well. Ellie, very quickly, there's another story on that front page spread by you. Students who achieve the same set of marks are being awarded widely different final degree scores. That's at UK universities, and it's according to a new analysis.
Yeah, so it's all about how the fact that universities have different degree algorithms. So that's the, you know, the set of rules that translate module outcomes into a final degree classification. But this analysis is sort of the first to show that actually, you know, depending on which university you're at and therefore which degree algorithm is used, you know, you could get a completely different mark, even with the same sort of set of scores. So they kind of used a sample of real results, and the academic kind of looked at 6 different potential algorithms and found that, you know, across the students, the proportion of those getting a first class degree could range from between 16% to 32%. So yeah, it's quite a big range.
I think what's significant about this is that there was a report by Universities UK and Guild HE on this issue back end of last year, which suggested that the use of these different algorithms appears to have a limited impact on the overall profile of awards made. Twice the proportion of students getting a first class degree, does seem to challenge that statement. So I'll be interested to see what people make of that study.
Indeed. Well, again, you can read that online at timeshighereducation.com. A little earlier today, I spoke to Simon Baker, our data editor. He's authored one of our features this week. A lot of Team THE are actually out at Davos at the moment at the World Economic Forum. And the forum itself has a community of universities called the Global University Leaders Forum. And I asked him what he wrote about for his feature, which is how powerful these universities are in terms of research clout, and also how they perform in terms of tying links with industry. And here's what he had to say.
The World Economic Forum has this kind of group of universities that it refers to as its university community. It's called the kind of Gulf, not to be confused with the geographic Gulf, obviously, but it's the Global University Leaders Forum, is what they call it. And I think it's been running for around about 10 years, I think, just over 10 years now. All you need to know, really, I suppose, is it's the top universities in the world. If you look at our rankings, it's every university in the top 10. Pretty much a good share of the universities are in the top 50. But I think over time, they've also sort of tried to make it more representative of some countries that aren't in that top 50 of the rankings. So there's some other universities in there as well, like Cape Town, South Africa, some other universities that aren't necessarily in the top of the rankings, but mainly it is the sort of top universities in the world.
And you've been looking at how they work with industry and some of the lessons that other universities can learn about what they do. Interesting you say some of them aren't just top universities, because when we've looked at innovation and industry connections in THE, it's often not the top universities that do it well. But these universities do it well, and there's some lessons there for others.
Yeah, that's right. And what's interesting about the kind of characteristics of this group, when you look at the sort of data on the amount of research they publish, is, firstly, they represent a huge share of the world's research, actually more than, say, the UK or Germany, you know, put together. Mm-hmm. I suppose that might not be surprising, given you're talking about the best universities in the world, but still, it's quite staggering that, like, you know, only a couple of dozen sort of universities can produce so much research that it's actually more than like whole nations. Mm. And that's pretty astounding. Probably more interesting from sort of my point of view, given you've got Harvard and Oxbridge in here, you're always going to get large research volumes. But what was interesting was that if you look at the amount of times their work is sort of cited in patents for inventions, the rate at which their sort of work is cited is more than anyone, any research nation. It's more than the US. I mean, that's quite staggering, actually, because you're sort of essentially saying that you know, these universities on their own have a bigger effect on kind of new discoveries than you know, the whole of the United States. I mean, that's that. In some ways, that's kind of worrying for some people. It might be because you're sort of saying, well, does that mean all economic impact is concentrated in just a few universities? Well, the answer is yes. And whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, it opens up a debate about it. I suppose the other aspect to the data which sort of Elsevier produced alongside some rankings data we looked at for this was that it also shows you that the companies that these universities work with in terms of when they collaborate with them. And there's, in the feature, we look at the sort of top 20 companies, so this collaboration. And these 20 companies alone sort of represent, I think I worked out, it was about a third of all the sort of industry collaborations between these universities and the commercial sector. So 20 companies, 27, I think, you know, universities driving global innovation. ruling the world. So yeah, there you go. But so the companies, it's not surprising in a way, they're massive companies. You're talking about Microsoft. Talking about huge big pharma companies like GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca, etc., Google, IBM, you know, all massive companies, which I suppose their economies of scale mean that they can devote a lot of money to working with academics and doing research, even if it necessarily doesn't always produce a new product line, you know. So, but yeah, it really does raise some very interesting questions about kind of the nature of industry collaboration and whether it's just the big players doing it.
That was Simon Baker speaking to me a bit earlier. Chris, back to you. A group of public colleges in the US we're writing about this week is to offer degrees with guarantees. What does that mean?
Yeah, the value for money is one of the big watchwords in higher education at the moment, and that's true in the US as much as it is in the UK or any other sector. What this story, which is by Boston-based journalist John Marcus, is about, it's looking at the growing number of universities and higher education institutions in the US which are offering essentially warranties with their higher education tuition. For example, 27 public colleges of applied technology in Tennessee offer retraining at no charge if their graduates fail state or national professional exams. You've got, I guess, part of the reason this is happening, the competition for the for-profit or online sector, people like Udacity promise students money back if they don't get their jobs. There's also a number of traditional universities doing similar things. A number of universities in New York let students finish their degrees for free if it takes them longer than 4 years. And Davenport University, which is based in Michigan, provides a sort of top-up tuition at no cost to students who haven't got jobs within 6 months of graduation.
Any concern this makes the students a little bit lazy? They think, well, I'll go, I'll throw my dice, see if I get a job, I can always go back.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a question I asked. But that said, there's you know, some careful rules around this. It's usually around repeating courses at no cost as opposed to refunding. There are cases of refunds. But having to repeat a course, not perhaps quite as enticing as being able to get your money back. I mean, I guess what's interesting about this, not only does it respond to the sort of concerns about value for money and the accountability of higher education and indeed teaching quality in higher education, but it's, you know, one of sort of two opposing trends going on in the US at the moment. You've got pressures around value for money and accountability like this. At the same time, you've got Donald Trump's administration, which is actually looking to sort of roll back a lot of the accountability around higher education, particularly regarding student loans and private universities. This, of course, being a president who paid, you know, millions of pounds to settle lawsuits linked to his own for-profit university. Nevertheless, you know, there's also a, you know, congressional effort around improving provisions for refunds of loans from students who sort of perhaps fall short of career expectations. So a big debate in the US, and I'm sure particularly with the Trump administration, not one that's going to go away anytime soon.
Indeed. Well, you can read that whole story on page 15 of the magazine this week. Matthew, over to you. What's in the book section this week?
Okay, well, the lead review is a review of a book called Hamlet and the Vision of Darkness, and it's illustrated by a rather striking picture of an actor playing Hamlet, looking meditatively not at Yorick's skull, but at a piece of sponge cake.
Yeah, I saw that. What's the sponge cake?
Well, I think you'll have to read the review to understand that. But the guy who's written it is a sort of expert in the intellectual history of the time, and Hamlet is normally considered a sort of deep thinker by most people's standards, but Rhodri Lewis argues that in fact he's thoroughly mired in bullshit and that he utters pseudo-profundities worthy of Yoda. So it's a rather radical revisionist take on Hamlet, and it's reviewed by Peter Smith, who's an expert on Shakespeare and performance, who is discussing essentially whether historical approaches to Shakespeare approaches based on what the plays are actually like in performance, how much they can speak to each other or how much they're completely at cross purposes. And my own column discusses the second volume of David Lodge's memoirs, and people who've read his campus trilogies will remember that they're full of academics swanning around the world, going to conferences, having a lot of sex, drinking, and not spending more than time in the conference hall than they can help. Right. And this memoir discusses the reality or otherwise behind what he describes in his books.
Sounds like that should have been on the front page. Thank you, Matthew. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. I believe it's about the 310th podcast that THE has published. I remember the first when we started them about 5 years ago. This is indeed my last. I'll be handing over the reins. Yes, indeed, to more than capable colleagues from next week. But for now, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.